Brad Shepherd, West Coast defender, has been forced to retire. Symptoms from two concussions sustained last season continue to plague him. And it's another one for the concussion file, sadly, and a very good player too.
Yeah, I was really surprised and taken aback when this was first speculated, because he played 20 games. So it wasn't something, it sort of just bobbed up. I know he had two concussions late in the year, but was, for me, unexpected. And even through his words, he was hoping to be there this year and he did everything that he could. But he's been deemed medically unfit to continue playing. Let's have a listen to what he said to West Coast media yesterday.
The emotion is definitely heightened. Seeing the guys for the first time today as a playing group and the coaches and support staff, you know, I never thought that I was going to be in this position. I was still hopeful that I was going to play and come back to pre-season initially, and yeah, things turned the other way pretty quickly, and it sort of makes it real being in the surroundings of the football club, being around your teammates, your coaches, support staff. It makes this whole situation real. Felt a lot of weight has been on my shoulders since that last game against Fremantle. I think having those prolonged concussion symptoms have been around for 3 months now. I think post-game still got it, so it's 3 months down the track, which has led me to go through some quite rigorous testing to figure out what's going on, and unfortunately they found it through what they did find is, one, there's a brain there, so I was pretty pumped with that, but secondly it's just the risk of playing AFL football, and you know, I was deemed unfit to continue.
So at 30, he's finished. Now he's the second West Coast Eagle in the space of 12 months on the back of Dan Venables, a young man also horrifically having to retire as well after one that he copped at training. So the broader discussion is, where are we at with concussion? Now, you've done a lot of work with Kingy recently, and I don't think there's been a stronger voice on concussion in terms of AFL media than Kingy, and he says that it's the biggest issue facing the game. My view is it gets to a point where you can only do so much. And I think we're at that point now. Now, I heard Brad Scott speak that they are going to crack down on accidental head knocks this year, and they're going to try and outlaw that. But how deep can you go? Because, I mean, at what point does it get to? I remember speaking to Gary and Tim about it after Patrick Dangerfield, I think, cleaned up Jake Kelly earlier on in the year with an accidental head clash. Are we going to get to the point where you rule things out that make AFL footy as good as it is? Now, I have complete sympathy and I understand the seriousness of it, but the AFL can't do much more and make the game any safer than what they have besides taking out the high mark, or besides penalising teammates for accidental contact with their own team, or what if a player tries to smother the ball and gets kicked in the head? I just don't know how much further we can go to make the game any safer. It's never been safer right now.
Well, there's a place where the AFL can go a lot further, and we can go infinitely further, and that's the protocols once a player has been concussed, because 12 days isn't enough. Mm. And you listen to enough experts, and we've had a heap of them on this program and on this station right over the course of the last few years in particular. 12 days is not enough. There needs to be a greater science behind how long players should be stood out of the game for. No one likes to see players missing. Mm. But this is where I think we need to get a lot better at it. And hopefully we do. Hopefully this is just the start of it. And we get to a stage now where you get a concussion and there's a greater testing mechanism behind it, more science behind it, and those players are missing more football for their life. This is for their life after footy. Like, Brad Shepherd's 30 years of age. Now, the concussion that he sustained, you mentioned it snuck up on you, it was round 22 against Fremantle. It was delayed onset. He had one earlier against Carlton. He's still suffering symptoms from that 3 months on. Mm. That's quality of life stuff.
100%. I'm fully with you on that. But something in me says you sign up to play a dangerous sport, you accept the risks that go with it. And that's the case across all sports. I mean, the NFL have had major issues. They've clamped down on that. The game is to a point now where you're going to get some concussions and it's unavoidable. Like, you can go up for a high mark, you can drop it and come back down and smash your head on the ground and get concussed. Now, that's no fault of the AFL. That's just the game that we play. Now, to your point, I'm not sure they fully understand yet the science behind concussion and how long is enough to be out of playing. Like, because every player
there's not
different.
Enough testing behind it.
Well, and every individual is different. So Brad Shepherd copped that knock and he's still suffering symptoms 3 months on, another player might have copped that knock and been fined 3 days later. So every individual reacts differently. It goes to the point of how many times you've been concussed in the past as opposed to how you're going to react. And the more concussions you get, the easier it is to get concussed and all of that. But I'm not sure they fully know. My concern is, though, we're going to cut too deep in the game and we are going to lose what makes the game great. Because I saw Callum Ward get poleaxed in a prelim final in 2016 from the knee of an opposition player. That's the most dangerous thing you can do on a footy field.
There's still room. There's still room for accidents.
Completely fine.
There's still room for accidents.
Well, they're saying they're going to cut down on accidents, and we saw, you know, the David McKay one this year, complete accident. Like, so I just hope those types of things, players aren't penalised, because you've got to remember this is the toughest game to play in the world. Players are making instant decisions. They've never been greater athletes running at full speed, and we're going to slow it down on replay to within an inch of its life and penalise players for exactly that, accidents, when you sign up to play a dangerous sport.
Jacob Townsend, in fact, he signed for Southport Sharks, I saw overnight. I was pretty sad when I heard that he'd pulled the pin yesterday. It was made official anyway. An absolute roller coaster of a career, wasn't it? The highest of highs and the lowest of lows. If you go back over the timeline of things, have a listen to this. He was his own selection at GWS, fell out of favour, traded to Richmond, delisted and re-rookied by Richmond. A year later, delisted by Richmond for good. Joins Essendon in the supplemental selection period. Delisted by Essendon. Rookied by Gold Coast. Delisted by Gold Coast. Overlooked by Gold Coast in the rookie draft. Invited to train on, but turned that down to call it quit. So at the end of that, Kane, 62 games, 10 years, 4 clubs. What an amazing journey.
Oh, it is. And we celebrate the superstars of the game and those that win all these achievements. What is equally impressive is the journeyman, and we've seen them over the years, and send us through your temper text, but 10 years, 62 games, 6 games a year across, what was it, 3 clubs with all those bits and pieces that you just, there you go. And I think we're going to speak to him, aren't we?
We're going to speak to him tomorrow, which will be great. He actually did an interview with Cal Toomey on the AFL website yesterday, which is a great read. And there's an anecdote there, because he'll be forever remembered by Richmond fans for that late 2017 blitzkrieg, won't he, when he just caught fire, broke into Richmond's team. Now, Dimmer tells him, Cal reported here, in round 22 when he came in, all he needed to do was kick 6. Towner, all you need to do is go out there and kick 6 and you'll stay in. And that's exactly what happened. He did kick 6, and then he kicked 5, kept his spot all the way through to the drought-breaking premiership where he kicked 2 in the win over the Crows.
It was that Carlton fans remember, the player that they had, nicknamed Rhino.
Luke O'Sullivan.
That's it, who was just one of those journeymen. I'm not sure in terms of... He played 50 games, I think, after a long period of time. But those players that scrap and fight and toil and great clubmen don't get the massive amount of games but have a huge impact on the clubs that they're at. So if you've got a favourite one of those, I played with a guy called Toby Thurston's who was instrumental in our premiership and just stuck around for 10 years. It took him 5 years to get his first game. It was extraordinary.
I went to school with Emu. He was an absolute pest, Toby Thurston. So he would have been right at home in that environment. I mean, I was rapt that he got that premiership and kicked a few snags too on the day. He'll forever have that, the big Emu. He didn't have a future at school, I can tell you that much. He was an absolute pest. Right, time for the 7:30 news headlines. I know he's not listening. We're off to get him a cafe coffee. We're back with more shortly on Summer Breakfast. Welcome back to Summer Breakfast, Champions League score update. If you don't want to know them, then just turn us off for a second. AC Milan lead Liverpool 1-0. Ajax have had their game against Sporting Lisbon levelled 1-1. The Portuguese have squared it up. Real Madrid still up 1-0 against Inter. And Borussia Dortmund lead Besiktas 1-0. Toby Thurston's, we just left the conversation on, Kane. Your old teammate, my old schoolmate. I've always wondered something, and Nathan's plucked this out, a bit of audio for us. Now, you might not know the answer to this, but when everyone goes up to receive their premiership medal, it's a very special moment. I mean, it's a lifetime's work for a lot of people, a lifetime's dream since you're a kid. You're up there on the dais with your medal. You might never get back there again. You want to commemorate it and remember it for absolute ever. It's a special moment. You never get it back. This was Toby Thurston's on the podium in 04.
Cat dog.
What was that?
Well, he's been asked about this a few times, I believe. So I believe it was a Nickelodeon show, and there was a character that was half cat, half dog.
Right.
Now, why he chose to
is that a dare or something?
At that moment, I think it was a dare. I think he's...
Bet gone wrong.
The town that Toby Thurston's grew up. Might have been
Crib Point.
Crib Point.
Not a town you sort of go out of the way to visit, to be honest.
I think he had some rough and ready mates in Crib Point that may have dared him to say that in that moment. So, yeah, not his... Maybe not his finest. It wasn't a Shane Crawford moment, was it?
It wasn't you were wrong or anything like that either.
Here it is.
It wasn't here it is. No, it wasn't Ball Ruse's
here it is.
It was cat dog.
Cat dog.
With the breeze from the Stanley Street end. Big shout, he's got in. He's out. Kay McDermott getting the edge. That's one for two at the Gabba.
The perfect outswinger there from McDermott.
McDermott got him. Yes, beautiful catch. That's now three for three at the Gabba. McDermott bowling perfect line to the left-hander.
Oh, yes. How many times did we see that? Craig McDermott, Billy the Kid, 71 tests for Australia. He took 291 wickets at 28, 138 ODIs for 203 scalps at 24. With that outswinger, his chief weapon. Look, he might have had us two for none here, Kane. But on the third time of asking with Craig, we've
got him.
Got him. Billy the Kid, welcome to SEN.
Yeah, how you going, boys? Sorry about that. Caught up with a couple of meetings and, anyway.
Hey, it's all good. To be honest with you, Craig, this countdown has given us an excuse to play some great Aussie moments. And we revisited Steve Waugh's stunning catch at the G in that 89 day nighter against the Windies. Now, Tugger's obviously revered for that catch up against the side screen, Merv Hughes bearing down. But what should get far more acknowledgement is the fact that none of that would have happened at all if not for your stunning slower ball that bamboozled Roger Harper.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, I've wanted to talk about that for many a year, but Steve always takes the limelight. So, you know, it's one of those things. No, it was a great catch from Steve. It's back in the days when you could run around the side screen and we'd jump over the fence and catch the ball.
Yeah, so, exactly.
And back in the 50s.
Yeah. So you saved your best for England too, it must be said. So it's timely that we have you on. And England actually last night released their team for the first test. And Jimmy Anderson isn't in it. Clearly the most successful fast bowler of all time is underdone. But how happy would the batsman in that Aussie dressing room be, do you think, Craig, particularly given the conditions it looks like we'll get up there?
I don't think that they'll be sort of that worried about Jimmy, to be honest, because it's really the Duke ball in English conditions that he really bowls super well in. And touch wood, I'm relentless. Don't really want to say this, but he'll probably get wickets in the second test. But he hasn't bowled well in Australia any series. So, and if he's underdone, well, you know, that's one of their decisions. But they've got some other good bowlers. Broad's right up there as one of the world's best bowlers. So they've got Stokes and so forth. So, you know, they've got a good attack. They've got a good batting lineup across the board. So.
The toss is always interesting. We just spoke to Jared Waitley about that and perhaps each captain maybe wanting to bowl first but not being brave enough to make the call if they win the toss. The conditions up there, Craig, and the thought of what it may produce today?
Yeah, you really just got to get through that first session in Brisbane and then it flattens out beautifully, and probably the second day is probably the best to bowl. So it's just one of those things. Every time we, even when I was coaching the Australian team, we'd look at it and have a bit of a green tinge, and then we'd just bat. So I think Australia would win the toss and bat, even though, you know, we've got the great bowling attack that we've got. Nathan Lyon will turn the ball on day one because it'll be a bit tacky, all that sort of stuff. And I think England will go through the same thought process and bat as well.
We're hearing that Adam Gilchrist will present Alex Carey with his baggy green this morning. Now, your first test was back in 84 against the West Indies, where you did take six wickets. The nerves of that moment and every cricketer's dream have been presented with that baggy green.
Yeah, mine got sent in the mail, actually, but one of those things. But I didn't really know I was playing until sort of 20, 25 minutes before the game started. AB went out to toss and ran back past me and said, "You're in, mate. Good luck." And that was it.
That's it.
So that's the way they did it in those days. There's not the fanfare, which they deserve the fanfare. They get it. It's an important moment in your cricketing life, and it's great the way they do that in all three formats now. So And for him, Alex Carey, to have Adam Gilchrist, such a legend for Australia, with the gloves and the bat, to present his cap to him is sensational.
Where is your baggy green currently?
It's sitting in at the top of my cupboard with some of my other memorabilia. So I've got a little bit, but I haven't got a massive amount anymore.
Hey, Craig, professional sport has come such a long way, not just sports science and everything around that, but even just coaching when it comes to professional cricket. Now, there was never any such thing as a bowling coach in your day, and you've done two stints of that with the Aussie team, of course, but I was struck by an anecdote where you'd played 41 tests when the late and great Ray Linwell gave you an enormous piece of wisdom, didn't he, in it? And it pretty much shaped the remainder of your career.
Yeah, it did. I think it might have been, it actually would have been before 41 tests, I reckon, but it was quite early in my career, and Ray Lynn was in the Cricketers Club having a casual beer, as he did in his suit, and we were having a set of wicket after we'd been rolled by, I think it was by New Zealand, and he came out of the middle, and I was bowling off my long run, and he said, "Put your fingers on the paint, son. It'll make it a lot easier for you to swing the ball consistently." And I had both my fingers pretty close together on the seam, and I put them out on the paintwork and just angled the seam a little bit, changed my life, and obviously just getting the length right after that. And the world was my oyster after that, and staying fit and bowling well. But that piece of advice was, just gold.
And you were great far more often than the opposite. But did Bob Simpson have something called the naughty boy nets in your time as well?
That's exactly what we were doing out in the middle of that particular day. That was the naughty boy centre wicket practice.
Right.
So if we got towed, we were sitting, out in the nets, doing some extra practice or extra fielding or whatever. But, as hard as that was to deal with, it shaped us into a very, very good cricketing team.
We've been discussing that this morning, the role of the coach of the Australian cricket team and Justin Langer and the pressure that he has been under. What makes a good coach?
Oh, look, I think Simo was a good coach. He was a good people manager, and he knew how to talk to another person who he knew would talk to you about your game, and vice versa, he'd talk to you as well. So he was a tough taskmaster. He turned us into the best fielding side in the world, there's no doubt about that. But he just knew how to handle people. Sometimes he didn't like it, what he said, but you just got on with it and trained hard. And, again, we became one of the best teams in the world around that era.
Mm. We're having a chat to Australia's leading fast bowler of a strike bowler of the 1990s, Craig McDermott, thanks to Foxtel, Australia's only dedicated sport 4K Ultra HD channel. Craig, your relationship with Alan Border. Now, AB's statue went up at the Gabba yesterday, which made me think of you too. There's been some infamous conversations that have lived on for a very long time. How was your relationship with AB? Oh, we might have lost him. You there, Craig? We got you back?
You dropped out.
Ah, we got you. We got you. I'm not sure if you caught that question.
No, I didn't. I'm sorry.
Alan Border's statue went up yesterday at the Gabba. So it got me thinking about your relationship with AB as a captain. There's some infamous pieces of audio that have stood the test of time. But how was your relationship with AB?
I was only showing a couple of my business partners that video yesterday, believe it or not, but getting a good cackle out of it. I don't know what the kerfuffle was, really, because I wanted to go to the Pizza Hut and AB wanted to go to McDonald's. That was the problem.
It was the old next plane home. I think you were more angry at yourself, though, weren't you, reading back upon that particular tour game?
Yeah, I was busting to not play the next county game, so I wanted to bowl well, and I was bowling a few no-balls, and I'd broken Brian Rose's arm in the first innings, and I just wasn't happy with myself. And I just grabbed I bowled a wide and a no ball that game, that particular over, and I snatched my hat off the umpire, and I was walking back to final, and I was spewing at myself, and AB just picked the wrong time to come down and talk to me and follow me down to the thing when I had the shits and he had the shits. So it imploded a little bit for about 10, 15 seconds, but it's remained a bit of commentary and banter for a long period of time. But my relationship with AB was very good. So he was a good kid, good skipper, a tough taskmaster. He led from the front, and he deserves to be immortalised out the front of the Gabba, no doubt about that, from that point of view. 160-something, 63 or 65 test matches. It's an unbelievable feat.
Absolutely. So from one skipper to the next, and Pat Cummins and the demands of a fast bowler and captaining his country, Craig, how do you think you'll go?
I think Pat's a pretty smart cookie. We've got a good bowling lineup. Nathan Lyon will obviously take a fair few of those overs out of the sails of Paddy Cummins, but he's going to have to make the right decisions when, if he's bowling well, when to bring himself off and all that sort of stuff, so he doesn't cook himself. But I'm sure that he's going to be able to do that quite well. And with Steve Smith, his VC, you know, I watched an interview from Pat last night. He was talking about, you know, Smithy moving fields and stuff, you know, if he's a bit cooked from the previous over or whatever. And I'm sure that will work very, very well in Pat's mind.
Craig, just before we let you go, we're nearly out of time. I've got to ask you about Merv Hughes, who you formed such a great partnership with the Fruit Fly. Tell us something about Swerve and Mervin.
We're in New Zealand in 1993, actually, and our physio, Errol Walcott Hooter, who's very well known, and he was sort of starting to clamp down. We were heading from New Zealand straight to the West Indies, to England for the Ashes in 1993, and Simo was putting the acid on a few boys to lose some weight, and Swervin only ever carried the odd 1 or 2 kilos, obviously. He came out of the shower with the towel sort of just barely wrapping around that great physique of his. And Errol had been down to the local hardware store and bought a flash pair of new scales, nice glass scales. So everybody had to do the weighing and the calipers and, you know, all that sort of stuff that we were just introducing in those days. So Merv came out of the shower with a towel on, and Hooter said to Merv, "Just come over here and jump on the scales." Swerve and said, "Oh, no drama." So he's run up about 3 or 4 metres, jumped about 0.5 metre in the air and come down on the scales and smashed him. So he said, "That's the end of the weigh-in, boys."
Oh, it's another time. And it's a time we remember so well. Hey, Craig, great to have you on. Appreciate you sharing some of your insights and also your memories this morning. Thanks a lot.
No problem, boys.
Craig McDermott there, former Aussie quick, former Aussie bowling coach and a great character of the game. And a reminder, the Vodafone Melbourne test starts December 26, Boxing Day, of course, at the MCG. Seats selling fast, search Ashes tickets. Well, it was worth the wait for him, Kane, I reckon.
Absolutely worth the wait. I've heard a lot of skinfold and weight stories and athletes trying to use tactics to either get themselves lower or to dodge them. I haven't heard anything quite like that.
Foxtel is the only place to watch every ball of the Vodafone Ashes series. It's in 4K Ultra HD. Well, I think it's safe to say that Lauren Jackson is one of the world's best female basketballers of all time. She was the first Aussie player to be inducted into Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. It was a career that included 4 Olympic medals, 2 WNBA titles, 3 MVPs. She was a 7-time All-Star as well. But as we said earlier, Kane, the best often pay a price. And for Lauren, that has been a degenerative knee injury that not only cut her career short, but saw her living in pain along with some hip and back ailments as well. But she's found a solution. Lauren, hello. Welcome to SEN.
Hey, how you going?
Hey, we're well here. Thanks a lot for joining us. So you underwent countless surgeries while playing, and in fact, you've been pretty open about your battle with prescription medication. But how have you overcome it?
Oh, look, I mean, it's been a work in progress, but in the last couple of years, I had to go to the GP a couple of years ago, and I just had a discussion around my options because, you know, obviously when I retired, I was, you know, dead set keen on getting rid of all those medications from my system. And then, you know, wanting to live a healthy life with my kids and just be the best version of myself, obviously, the pain got a little bit too much for me. So I went and, I took that first step and had that conversation and was prescribed CBD oil and prescription medication. And it's definitely changed my life for sure. Like, there's no doubt.
So the medicinal cannabis was first raised by your GP. Is that right?
Well, I had a look at my options because I wanted to know what all of my options were because I needed to get off and stay off the harder, harsher kind of drugs. And, you know, I knew what they did to me during my career and, you know, obviously battling a lot of operations and dealing with pain and all sorts of weird and wonderful issues I had during my career. And, you know, it got to the point where I was, you know, not doing too much. The pain was sort of inhibiting me around the house with my kids and things like that. And so I really wanted to make a change. And so I'd go to the gym and then I wouldn't be able to move for like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So it was kind of hard for me to really do anything. So I had that conversation with people close to me as well as my GP. And I then was prescribed it. So And look, I have to say it really has changed my life because I just feel like I'm very healthy. I'm strong. I'm recovering really well from the gym. I've been training a lot. And yeah, I feel fit, you know, for first time in a very long time.
That's great. And I guess what's the reaction? What was the reaction like at the time from others? Because particularly around the uneducated when it comes to this sort of stuff, and there's a lot we don't, well, a lot that I don't understand. I'll put my hand up. And there is a stigma with it. How was that first foray into it? How was it received?
Look, I come from a pretty traditional sort of family unit, and anything like this, you know, my mum and my dad kind of pricked their ears up. But look, I think the stigma's changing around medicinal cannabis, and the more it's talked about and the more they see on a current affair and in the news and things like that, the more they're starting to understand its benefits. And mum and dad were actually really open to it straight away. We had the conversation because I wanted to be open and honest with what I was doing. And look, they've been fully supportive. And I think, you know, if anyone was to ask them how they to sort of see me and how I've evolved over the last couple of years, they would be very honest about it and say that it has helped me. But look, like I said, I think the stigma's changing, and it was something that I was concerned about initially. But I think too, like I said, it's people, the more people talk about it, the more people discuss it, they understand the health benefits and how good it actually is. For some people, I'm not saying it works for everybody, but for me, it's been very, very beneficial in my day to day.
What advice would you give to other athletes, Lauren? Because we're very focused and single-minded, and you just try and get yourself up from week to week or game to game, and you do anything to get to that point. It sounds like you did that with prescription meds and painkillers during your playing days, but you often don't think about the long-term effects. What advice would you have for the current athlete?
Oh, look, I think it's really clear to me now, for me, like looking back on my career, and I think, see, at the moment I'm training pretty hard because my body feels good enough to be able to do it, which is awesome. But it's the way you take care of your body and the way that you take care of your intake, so your food, like how much alcohol you're drinking. Obviously, you want to stay away from that. But it is actually like the whole picture. It's not just focusing on the gym or just getting up shots or kicking a ball or whatever. It's literally every single thing you do is going to contribute to the way that you recover and the way that your body, you know, is when you get older. And I think those were the things that I didn't focus on when I was young. When I was young, I was like, you know what? I'm going out there to play. I don't care what anyone says. I'm going to have the time of my life. And I did, you know, I absolutely did. But, you know, obviously that ended my career pretty quickly.
Was there any, do you think, I mean, negligence from the medical professionals, or were they too lax in handing out painkillers and things like that? We've seen stories over the past, and is there any fault there, do you think? And can doctors be a little bit more cautious with how they treat injured patients and sports people?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a different sort of kettle of fish for kettle of fish. I don't even know what I was saying then. But it's different for female athletes because you're playing in like 3 or 4 teams a year. So all of a sudden you've got different cultures, different countries, different medications, different doctors, different everything. So there's no consistency with your treatment, and it's really difficult. And as much as I would absolutely say there's no negligence at all, I think for me personally, it was just I was in a routine, I was all over the world, and I was just trying to get by, you know, and I think that's something that female athletes need to be careful of. And I think there is more education about it now. There's like, absolutely, I think that they sort of see it happening, and there's more education around prescription medication, and the way that they're taking care of their bodies now is much different to how I did when I was playing. So I think that, you know, it's part of this, you know, ecosystem where people sort of learn from the past and get better moving forward.
So you're now part of the Sports Advisory Board run by the Melbourne-based sports medicine company Levin Group, who we've spoken about a little bit on this program, actually, a number of times. Since you've been an advocate for this, how many others have come out and said that this has made a dramatic impact on their lives as well?
Oh, gosh, I really don't know. Like, to be honest, I'm just telling my story, you know, and working with Levin has been fantastic because they're putting so much effort into the research aspect of it and making sure that, you know, through the trials and everything that they're, able to really show the results, and it's pretty awesome the work that they're doing to make this happen. So I'm not 100% sure, honestly. I'm just telling my story with it, and like I said before, I think part of reducing the stigma and helping people get the treatment that they need is by actually talking about it and discussing the benefits of it. That's sort of where I'm at.
A few other well-known sporting identities on that board as well. Alistair Clarkson, Damien Oliver. I think Damien Hardwick's invested in Levin Health as well, which obviously is directed by Mark Brayshaw. So you're loving life again, Lauren. You're a mum to two little boys, and they're only going to get harder to catch from here, aren't they? So you've got to be mobile.
That's right. Yeah, no, that's, part of my health kick at the moment, I think. It's just making sure that I can keep up with those two. And, my two-year-old weighs about 50 kilos already, I'm in for a big one with these two, let me tell you.
And are you back on the court a little bit as well? I mean, would you have ever imagined that prior to this?
No way. I honestly, I've been training and, the idea of getting back out on the court again and at whatever level is definitely on my mind. It's something that I want to do. And the way that things are sort of progressing, I feel like, it's not out of the question. So, I'm recovering so much better than I ever have. But again, like I was talking about before, I'm in such a different headspace. I am a mum. So, my goal and my motivation is to make sure that I'm fit and healthy for my kids. So, and being the best version of myself that I can be. So I'm a great example to them. So it's a little bit different. So if I did get back out on the court, my motivation is very different. My mentality will be very different. And I just want to enjoy my life and live it to the fullest.
Jeez, so. you get a shock, wouldn't you, Kenny, if you rock up to Wednesday night hoops at 5:30 and Lauren Jackson's on the
teach you a lesson.
Anyway, hey, but no pressure, of course, Lauren, because your kids do whatever they want to do in life. But am I right in saying your oldest has actually taken up the game?
Yeah, he's in. He's already playing Aussie hoops here awesome. In Albury, and yeah, he loves it. The kids have got a little basketball court out the back, and they're pretty active kids. They're in the pool. They're on the court. They're riding their scooters. They're just normal kids, but they're just everywhere and doing everything. So it's fun.
And be honest, are you one of those mums there at the Albury Sports Complex at Aussie Hoops hooting and hollering when a young fella does something well?
Oh, I'm terrible. I always thought I would be the best and just sit back and be quiet like my parents were and just be sort of silently judgmental, but I am not silently judgmental, and I have to actually rein myself in occasionally. It's a bit embarrassing, actually.
Brilliant. We're so glad that life's turned around for the better for you. I mean, sad to see that and hear that you were and reading about the level of pain you're in the latter stages of your career and in retirement, but well done on turning it all around, and you've got an important role to play now as an advocate on the Sport Advisory Board. Thanks for joining us, Lauren.
Thank you very much.